So anyways, yeah, my talk is, it's a little bit strange. The International Criminal Court is, it's surrounded by controversies and criticism, and the normal thing to do in a talk is to jump in on one of those controversies. Mine's a little bit different, because instead of engaging in one of the arguments, I want to talk to you about the arguments. And since that format's a little weird, I'm particularly curious to get your reactions and see what you think about this. What I want to look at is the structure of the criticisms made about the ICC, and to sort of show how there's recurring patterns in those structures. So I'm not looking to take anything away from the criticisms, but I do think that if you have a global perspective of these recurring patterns, I think it enables one to be a little more skeptical and a little bit more sophisticated in how you assess the discourse. So what I want to show is, first of all, that the ICC is facing some contexts that are a little bit different from what was expected when the court was created, and that pushes the court into a situation where it can't really rely on any particular consensus in international or criminal law. And I have some images that I'll show you, hence the preference for the computer to work, so that you can sort of show what it's like in the field. Those new contexts put the ICC in this place where there's these different webs of tensions, there's these different axes, where it doesn't actually matter where they put their policy or where the judge puts the decision. Any given decision is vulnerable to attack from at least one side of the axis, or maybe both. And that's the stuff I'll show you. At some point we'll have some decisions, you'll be the prosecutor, you make the decision, I'll attack you. So something like that. But first of all, and the point I want to make too is that it's not just a matter of the ICC trying to strike the right balance. It's not that there is no right balance, that you're vulnerable to a criticism no matter where you draw the line. To start with, what kind of... So that I know how much detail to go into, what's the level of familiarity? How many people are just at the point where they've heard of the ICC and they just know the gist of its existence? So, like, who's there?
Everybody's world-class expert.
Is that right? Then I judge.
Like,
for example, would I need to... I assume that a significant chunk of the people aren't familiar with the details of the actual situations the court is in. Is that fair? Okay, yes, fair. Okay, cool. I want to tell you a little bit about these new contexts that the court works in. When the Rome Statute drafters were making the ICC, they were meaning to do something groundbreaking. They meant to depart from the way things were done before, but even still, their imaginations are still constrained by the experiences that the world had had up until then. And I have two kind of examples. Sorry, I'm a pacer. I have two examples of that. So one example is what I would call the assumption of aversion. I think if you polled the people at the Rome conference, everyone there thought that states would not like being scrutinized. So I think that most people at the conference would share these assumptions. Number one, ratifications are going to come in slowly because states don't want to expose themselves. Two, especially states with crimes on their territories, they're definitely not going to ratify because they have all the more incentive not to expose themselves. Three, you're not going to get referrals from states' parties because we know from human rights experience that states don't refer situations. Four, you're not going to get any referrals from the UN Security Council because the United States hates your guts and wants you to die. Five, if despite all those things you somehow got a case, then the state most affected by it is going to use these complementarity rules where a state can insist on its prior right to prosecute. So the picture, when you combine all those things, is that the ICC obviously is going to be a court with no cases. It's going to be a court with very little to do. And in fact, that's why people were so worried about the frivolous, crazy prosecutor launching borderline proceedings, because he's so desperate for something to do, right? And instead, of course, the reality has been totally the opposite. The ratifications come flooding in. We're already at 121. I kind of can't believe I'm alive, and the ICC has passed the 120. That's like a real It's a real thing. We made a real thing. Forming my other thesis, the ICC is a thing now. So 120 making it, you know, one of the big institutions. The 120 states include states with crimes on their territory. Referrals have come in, and most bizarrely, the referrals came in from states saying, hey, court, look at me. Look at the situation on my territory. The U.S., which was supposed to block all referrals by the U.N. Security Council, its position softened, so there's two cases referred by them. So instead of a court with no load, what we have is a court with an overload. This one little institution in The Hague, it's already investigating in seven situations in seven different countries. It's issued arrest warrants in all seven. It's had what I think is a pretty surprising success rate in getting people actually at the court. And it has about eight more situations also clamoring for attention and deserving attention. So there's one way in which we were way, way, way wrong. And it's going to have an effect because it means this overloaded court has to prioritize, select, choose, and the second you do that, you're into a world of legitimacy problems because everyone will have questions about your selection. So the second example of one of the assumptions we made that turns out to be questionable is what I would call it the assumption of transitional justice. If you think about our experience up until then, our whole experience was transitional justice, meaning that there had been a legacy of mass crimes. Then there was a transition, such that there's something new is in power. There's a new regime. The Allies have taken over Berlin. The Tutsis are back in power, right? And so there's the question of what to do with those past crimes. And the big two options were impunity or some sort of transitional justice. So then we create the ICC and sort of unwittingly invented a new thing that I think you could call it pre-transitional justice. Because we created this court, and I mean, we even said it with our mouths, right? The advantage of the ICC is it's going to be up and running when the crimes happen. It's going to avoid the startup delays that you have with tribunals. Up and running while the crimes are happening. So there is no transition yet. There's an armed conflict. So you have investigators running in with their little magnifying glasses trying to investigate a live conflict. So it's pre-transitional justice. Hallmarks of pre-transitional justice. The perpetrators that you want to go after are protected by armed groups. The territory you want to investigate in is out of control. Police powers are unavailable. And there's all these other actors that want to work in that same space that you're working in. Someone's trying to do a peace process. Someone else is trying to deliver humanitarian aid. Someone's trying to democratize. Someone's trying to demobilize the child soldiers. And in comes the ICC looking to do justice and sort of, you know, shake some things on the table, right? Oh, so I have these images. Oh, once I get rolling again. There we go. So there's my assumption. So I've got a couple images just to sort of help you. There we go. To help you see a little bit of this context. I think I will skip the discussion of our different situations. I just want you to sort of to put you in the shoes. When I talk about these tensions in this talk, I'm going to mostly talk about it from the point of view of the prosecutor because that's the point of view I know best. But the same tensions we're going to talk about also apply to the judges, so we can talk about that. So here you are, pre-transitional justice, you're trying to investigate these situations. You have problems. One problem is just transport, getting from place to place. To go from Kinshasa to Bunia, two spots in the DRC, they're 1,200 kilometers apart. The vehicles that you would use are breaking down. The radios you would use to call for help are breaking down. The roads are in bad condition, and so on and so forth. So just getting to these remote locations you need to get to go start your investigation, just getting on the ground is difficult. Maybe you want to hitch a ride. This is not the best photo, but maybe hitch a ride. The UN has these planes, the Antonov planes. They have a habit of filling up with smoke and falling out of the sky. But you know that. So there's an option. Your witnesses that you need to talk to, which is going to give you the crime base for your case, they're all in these scattered, isolated locations because usually they've run away, right? They're refugees or they're internally displaced. And there's a lot of sensitivities and difficulties here. So one, the witnesses you want to talk to have been traumatized, and so you can't just let your investigator, who's some sort of cough, just go up and start quizzing them, because that could wind up re-traumatizing them. So instead, before the ICC investigator can even talk to them, someone first who does victims and witnesses and trauma has to go talk to them first, see, is this a person that we can even ask without being re-traumatized. Languages, you might on one mission be dealing with people who speak six different languages. So you might have a little string of interpreters along. You might have one investigator, some victims and witness people, security. You know this ratio, they talk about tooth to tail ratio in the military? So like, your one investigator would need like a team of these people providing these other functions. There's another difficulty with the witnesses is you can't just roll, like, so there's some sort of internally displaced camp. You can't roll in there with your white truck that says United Nations on the side and your nice watch and your nice shoes and go start talking to people, because there's other people in the camp who are leaking information back to the armed groups or whatever. So you go bumbling around in the camp and then everyone's going to know who you talk to, so problem. So that means another complication for your investigation. You need to come up with ruses sometimes, a reason why a person has to disappear for a couple hours. Like, I guess I shouldn't give examples of the ruses. but you have to come up. So it's all very, very difficult and elaborate. Witness security. Your most important witnesses you need to protect them, especially linkage witnesses, the witness who can connect the top person to the crimes. The person who knows who gave the orders, they have to be protected. How do you do that? The obvious way to do witness protection is you rely on states. That's complicated. The state who's your buddy in one situation, you might be investigating them in the situation next door, so you have a very, very complicated relationship doing all those things. The conditions for the investigators aren't good. 90% of ICC staff have at some point fallen ill with malaria or whatever. The number one biggest problem, though, of course, is security. You're investigating these live conflicts. The people you're investigating are not keen on that. So you need someone to provide you security, but we're going to talk about this tension between independence and dependence. You need security, but you can't work too closely with any particular partner, so there's a giant problem. You would think the person you might go to for help is the UN. I mean, I'm a UN fan, and you know, I have this beautiful wheat sheet and this globe. Like, aren't they going to help the ICC? Like, you care about, you know, we're good causes. Let's work together. But the UN's been doing its thing for 50 years. It has its way of doing things. The ICC is the new kid on the block. You're disruptive. You're muddying up things that they would rather not have muddied up. So that relationship is actually very complicated. Even more complicated in the early days, because the Bush administration would occasionally smack down the UN for giving us help, leading to some scary situations, like if some of your investigators were supposed to stay in a UN camp, and then some UN bureaucrat changed their mind and wanted to throw them out into Bunia, which has two hotels, each owned by one of the armed groups you're investigating. That's a big giant problem, right? So difficult. So those are the kinds of situations. This is my last and favorite image, which I don't know why I put in the slide. It just to me means you've designed something. This is my metaphor slide. You've designed something. Like, let's say you designed an international criminal court, and then it's being used in a manner that's a little more wild and rugged than the designer first had in mind. So this is what my slide is supposed to be about. So that's the kind of picture. Now we get to the fun part where I talk about these tensions where you're trapped. There's so many different ways to launch into this. the function of law is to challenge power, right? Law restrains power. That's what law is supposed to do. At the same time, to get that done, law relies on power. Law depends on power to have the muscle to constrain power, right? So there's this funny relationship built in right there. There's a problem. Yeah, law constrains power. Law depends on power to do it. Independence and dependent. The ICC is legally independent. It has to be, right? Independent, impartial, etc. It is factually dependent, utterly and totally dependent. It is powerless on its own. So that's a problem, right? You are independent and dependent. I can give some examples of how this plays out. If you look at how past international institutions worked, you had Nuremberg, where the Allies had taken over Germany, and you've got control of the territory. Ditto Tokyo. Rwanda, the Tutsis are back, they're in control. Bosnia, you've got NATO all over the place, right? ICC is different. It's this pre-transitional justice, so that turnover hasn't happened. So some of the powerful actors, they're actually still there. They're still powerful. So either the territory is out of control, because there's armed groups, or the territory is firmly run by the state, which is committing crimes, right? So either way, you've got a problem. Territorial states are really interesting, I think, for an international prosecutor, because there's this, like, it's this duality. Under international law, the state of the territory is the lawful, legitimate authority source in that territory. If you want to work in their territory, you go to them, right? That's how the ICC statute part 9 works. Dear state, may I please do this and that, right? So under international law, you have to work with them. They are the lawful authority. On the criminal law side, though, they are also one of the objects of possible investigation. So you get this weird relationship. Your state, can you help me get license plates on my vehicles? And can you get me security for some people? And also, where were you on the 14th? awkward, right? So this is the kind of situation. Let me give an example. So you'll be the prosecutor, and we'll sort of show how this apology utopia. I'll explain apology utopia in a moment. Let's go back in time. You're the prosecutor. You haven't started any cases yet. And this is at a time when everyone is fearful of the crazy prosecutors going to launch frivolous proceedings, right? And you get a referral from a state. Uganda has given you a referral. Yeah. So you're excited about getting a referral from a state because it shows that you're not necessarily this disruptive influence, right? The state itself has turned to you and invited you in. This is great. Problem. The referral from Uganda says, "Dear prosecutor, I refer to you my enemies, right? I refer to you the situation concerning the Lord's Resistance Army." So probably you all know, but in Uganda, you've got Uganda government, the Lord's Resistance Army. We'll just stop with those two characters in that story. So, question I put to you is, what are we going to do with this referral? We take the referral, and then does that mean that we are a tool that can be pointed by a state at its enemies? Or are we pure, we reject the referral, and we say, we do not accept asymmetric referrals. And so then we're impeccable, but we don't have a case. So my question for you is, the options are going to be, who would take the referral, who would reject the referral? So let me throw it out to my prosecutors. Who here takes the referral? Some. Who rejects the referral? Oh, we've got a lot of abstainers. It's not okay. Not okay. Okay, abstainers. Oh, this is what we'll do. Boom. Okay, abstainers. This is for you, abstainers. Is there another option?
So I gave you the abstainers will pretend they haven't received the letter.
Yeah. So is there another option? The options I gave you were take it, reject it. What else can we do? Sorry, I know that normally you just come and you eat and but it's more fun this way. Apart from take it, reject it, like, does anyone have some clever way out of our puzzle here?
Take it and expand it.
Take it and expand it, yes. And of course, you looked into the history books and exactly, take it and expand it, which is exactly what the Office of the Prosecutor actually did, which I thought was very clever. We said, "Dear Uganda, thank you so much for your referral. Ooh, we have to take the referral in a symmetric manner. So you've actually just referred yourself as well as the LRA. What do you think of that? Which I think is clever, but what I'm going to show you is that still doesn't get us out. You cannot escape this apology versus utopia problem. Now, so let me tell you about apology and utopia. Are there Marty Koskinen fans here? Is anyone? So smart, that guy. His brain is gigantic. So Marty Koskinen writes that, he writes about the structure of international legal arguments, and he says any given international legal argument is vulnerable. Well, he shows lots of tensions, but one of them is apology versus utopia. Your argument is vulnerable to an apology attack, meaning your argument is just serving state interests. You're pointing to state practice, and the apology attack criticism is your argument is just based in what the powerful want. That has no normative pull. It's just obedience to power. The utopia attack is the other way, which is you are naively ignoring power. You're just making up pretty words, but it has no traction. It's just morality, but not politics. So any given argument can be attacked. Either it's apology because you're serving power, or it's utopia because you're ignoring power. I think that same structure can be applied to ICC, any policy that the ICC takes or any decision. So back to our referral problem. If we take the referral, then you get the apology attack. You're serving us. You're basically being like an attack dog for a state. We reject the referral, then we're all pure and good, but we have no case. So that's utopia. You've got your high-minded principles, but you're nothing on the ground, right? Then we have our clever in-between option, which is we take the referral but reinterpret it. But even that can't get you out of apology utopia. Even that can still be attacked. I think that there could be an apology attack. I think Uganda could have said, who do you think you are rewriting my referrals? I'm a state. I said LRA. You can't, right? They could have. They didn't. Or there's the apology attack. Sorry, that was the utopia attack. Utopia attack is who do you think you are rewriting my referrals. The apology attack would be, well, you have you formally reinterpreted this referral, but deep down we suspect that you're maybe still colluding with the states. So you always get one of these. The neat thing, again, there's no magic. There's no point in between. Does everyone remember the Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Remember that? So there was the porridge that was too hot, and then the porridge was too cold, and then the third porridge was just right. There was a bed that was too soft, and the other one's too hard, and then the third one was just right. This is not like Goldilocks in many ways. And one of the ways it's unlike Goldilocks is there is no just right porridge. You're always vulnerable to either one or sometimes both, like that example I gave. And I have lots of examples of this apology utopia thing. For example, the ICC has different trigger mechanisms. There's different ways to start for a case to start. One way a case starts is with these referrals from a state party. If you launch a case using a referral from a state party, then I'm going to bring the apology attack. Especially because it tends to be states are referring situations on their own territory. I'm going to say, oh, you're too close. The referral comes from a state that's right in there. That means you're going to be in there serving the interests of that state. That's the apology attack. So then you hear the apology attack, oh my goodness, that's right. I'm not going to use state party referrals. That's a bad idea. They're too close to the conflict. So then you get a UN Security Council referral. And you say, there, this is nice, because the UN Security Council is nice and distant. Then you get an apology attack on that one again, because now you're a tool of the P5. And now it's an apology attack with a north-south direction. You're a tool of the north against the south, neocolonialism, da-da-da-da-da, right? Apology. Oh my God, you say? I'm not going to use that Security Council referral anymore. So the third way you can start a case is proprio motu, which is the prosecutor brings a case, starts it all on his own motion. You do that, and then I'm going to say, utopia, what are you doing? Here you were launching a case, you have no support on the ground, you're not invited into the situation, da da da. And if you look at the literature, that's how it goes. So my point is, again, it doesn't matter which one you do, there's these attacks. So this is what I'm just trying to show, is there's these recurring patterns like that. More of your problems as a prosecutor. Remember, we've got this little court. It's overloaded, meaning you have to make decisions, you have to choose cases. that instantly means you have problems. One option is you could be comprehensive. You could say, I'm going to prosecute every case that shows that there's a war crime, I'm going to go prosecute them. If you do that, then we're going to say, oh, you're bloated. Oh, I shouldn't touch. You're bloated. You're inefficient. It's too expensive. In fact, the states of the world have said, we're not willing to pay. We're not going to pay for this anymore. You look at the Yugoslav tribunal. It had one region. They did 160 cases. And the states have said, we're not paying for your 160 cases anymore, so that's out. So you go, okay, fine, I'm going to select cases. I'm going to select situations. I'm going to only go to the most serious situations. And then, so a situation is like a country where something bad is happening. And then within the situation, you've got to pick your cases, right? The particular person in charges. So I'm going to select the most serious situations, and in them I'm going to do the most serious cases. The second you do that, now you're politicized. And the reason you're politicized is because regardless of what decision you make, someone else would have made it differently. And so they're going to say, why did you do A and not B? And the other neat thing is they can just ascribe a political motive to you. And the neat thing, and we'll explore this with an example, is you cannot disprove. Let's do it. You prove to me that you're not politicized. And just see what it's like. So I'm going to do a situation, and it's sort of Uganda, but I want it not to be Uganda, because I want it purely hypothetical in case any of you have links to Uganda. I don't want your politicization in here. So it's an imaginary country. You've launched a case. There's a state versus a rebel group. No question that you're going to start on the rebel group. The rebel group is responsible for thousands and thousands and thousands of acts of murder, sexual violence, mutilation, amputation, torture, abduction of children, sexual enslavement. No question, we're going to start with them. But then people say, well, show your impartiality. What about the government side? There's two sides in this war. What about the government? So you get your nerds. You've got nerds, by the way, who they have thick glasses and cool hair. Or no hair, and they're downstairs and they crunch through data, they do crime analysis, and they have all their nerd stuff. And so you say, hey nerds, what do you got on the government? And this, here's another reason why this is hypothetical, is because I don't actually know what the OTP has on the Ugandan government, but I'm told it's something a little bit like this, is not much. The people in this country say the UPDF is, everyone knows the UPDF is just as bad as the government side is just as bad as the rebels. But the bad things the government did were for the most part outside of your temporal jurisdiction, and they're outside of your subject matter jurisdiction. They're not the kinds of bad things you can deal with. So for your kinds of bad things, you've got like 20, 30 isolated things like an extrajudicial killing, that's interesting, but they're not connected in one case. It's like this person, that person. There's no command responsibility case. There's no pyramid that you can go after. So, but let's make it more appealing. Let's say, and this is not true in Uganda, I don't think, but let's say that maybe there's a guy and you could pin eight, somehow we'll make him responsible for eight extrajudicial executions. So there's your case. So the question is, should we bring a case against, should I put a team and bring a case on this government army guy for eight persons? Emphasis, I'm not saying that there is a case against anyone in Uganda, this is my hypothetical, I'm just making the facts like more tempting to go after the government. So there's a couple of issues though before you decide if you want to do the case. You have a finite number of investigation teams. If you put a team on this guy, then you can't, or you'll have to delay sending a team next door where there were 500 rapes, right? So you've got to manage your resources. So yes, this is my question. Who would bring the case against them? So you see the dilemma. If you don't bring it against the guy, then people are going to say, oh, you're one-sided. But if you do bring it against the guy, you might not be optimizing your resources. So who brings a case against the government guy? Okay, this might be an abstention show. Okay, that's good, 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 yes, good, good, good. And who doesn't bring a case against the government guy? Okay. And creative thinking time, is there an in-between option? This is a really hard question you might not have. I mean, it's do or don't, but You see the dilemma, right? The dilemma is, don't do it. People say you're one-sided. Do it. And you're kind of like letting evidence go stale in the case next door, right? You see the problem. Does anyone... Maybe you're not the kind of volunteer my creative ideas crowd, but does anyone have any other ideas of what to do with our... Yeah?
Refer one of the cases to Belt, so I've got one.
Not bad, right? Which is good, because then we can say complementarity. Complementarity is the principle where if states want to do something, that's cool. So, like, would be a great answer, right? Somehow claim success, right? Get someone else to do it and say, look, the ICC, right, would be perfectly smart. That would be a great idea, right? Another minimal one, which I wish the Office of the Prosecutor would do in Uganda, is they could at least write a report saying, dear world, the reason we haven't done the UPDF is the following. Instead, they just say nothing and just, they look bad. So that story kind of shows you some of these tensions you're going to have. One of them is, okay, so who were my people who didn't prosecute the guy? What's your name? Pardon me?
Yurini.
Did you have political motivations for your decision not to prosecute? I like the honesty. That's cool. We would never give the right?
They weren't the most important motivation.
They weren't the most important. Oh, the political considerations weren't... Your main concerns were formalistic, right?
No, they were justice-related. That is, if you have much more serious crimes on one hand, I think it's better for you to have those rather than the less serious.
Right. Good. But that's just what a politically motivated prosecutor would say, isn't it? Right? So... You're right? So this is the problem, is that you can't prove to me that you didn't prosecute because actually you're scared of the government or...
Well, you don't have to prove. It's you who has to prove. He does not prove anything.
Oh, that's not true. I throw him in the mud, sticks on you. I don't know. Okay, so maybe I do have to prove it. I don't know.
I would write a report, however, explaining why I have not done this.
Okay, yes.
They didn't just publish information all the time.
She wrote a report, and one cannot escape the suspicion that, in fact...
No, I did not go into this. I would just say, you know, I have 500 raids here, I have 4 extrajudicial killings, I have decided to go for the 500 raids.
Yeah.
That's the fact.
Which is good, right? And something a little bit like that happened in the ICC with the Iraq situation. We didn't investigate Iraq. We wrote a report saying, here's why we didn't go to Iraq. It didn't get criticized too much, actually, but nonetheless, people still would say, one can't escape the suspicion that perhaps, you know, there were political considerations. Isn't it convenient? So I guess this is the problem. Acquitting the powerful. If you find that someone powerful doesn't meet your standards, then I'm going to say, oh, you're scared of the powerful. That's political. And you still can't escape, because even if you go after the powerful, I'm going to say, craving NGO right approval and la la la, you are political. Or worse yet, you're the crazy prosecutor going after powerful people to your garzón, right? So this is just one of the points. I mean, Luis Arboron said allegations of political decision making are easy to make and difficult to rebut. I think she was wrong. I think they're impossible to rebut. It's what in philosophy of science they call it's non-falsifiable. It's a non-falsifiable hypothesis. You can't. So anyways, it's just sort of interesting. Other tensions that we saw in our little story, though, is you can either be impartial or look impartial. And what I mean by that is you can have impartial outcomes. You went after all groups. Or you can have impartial standards. I have one standard I apply to everybody, but sometimes that means they don't go after some groups. And different prosecutors have done it different ways. Carla Del Ponte from the ICTY, she was a little bit more on the I prosecute all groups. And to do that, she had to bring some really flimsy cases, so she was criticized for that. Luis Moreno Ocampo is at the opposite. He seems not to care what people think about the outcomes he generates, so then he's criticized on that one. So again, you can't avoid it. So that's another one of these tensions. Okay. Oh, yes.
One of the biggest controversies in the ICC is why Africa? Why are all your situations in Africa? That's probably the number one thing that's bothering people. And so the argument is the ICC is focusing on Africa for political reasons because Africa is weak. It can't resist. It's a neocolonialist agenda, etc. And there's a couple things I think about this. One is, if we go back to the literature of the 90s, I could provide you with 15 articles saying the West is ignoring crimes in Africa, and that shows that you're racist because an African lives are worth less than the others, you're neglecting, da 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 da. So then, okay, oh my God, we're racist, you're right, okay. I don't want to be racist, so here I come, da da da, bring the justice. Oh, you're neocolonialist, Western, you're constructing victims in Africa to perpetuate your narratives of African savagery, da da da. Oh, I'm a racist again. So, so there has to be an option. A, you're racist, not a racist, right? Like, there's got to be a way out of that one. Anyways, the prosecutor, the office of the prosecutor, its story on why all its cases are in Africa. It's a very boring story. They got the nerds, and the nerds are collecting their data, and they've got rules of measurement, rules of attribution, rules of bias control, rules of ambiguity control. They've got gravity standards, which are at least defensible, and they're applying it, and the gravest admissible situations are all in Africa. And the problem with that is, like, I think everyone just feels too sophisticated and worldly to believe such a thing, you know? Right, you know, politicized prosecutors. So, in fact, the fact that the OTP keeps... I mean, we almost a priori reject the possibility that they're crunching numbers and coming up with these things. And, like, government denies conspiracy is proof of the conspiracy. So, I don't know, it's a little bit funny. If I were... This is my campaign speech. If I were the ICC prosecutor, do you elect me after Fatou's done her 9-year term? No, if I were the ICC prosecutor, I would definitely do a case out of Africa, for sure. But what are my motivations? I would do a case out of Africa because I don't want to be criticized anymore. Here's my... I mean, it is embarrassing. That's an embarrassing list. They're all in Africa. If I were the prosecutor, I would take a case out of Africa because I don't want to get criticized. And I also have like a policy. I would say I need a case out of Africa to make an expression that the ICC is truly a global court, right? So I would take the case out of Africa, and everyone would say, Daryl, that's so great. You're not politicized. That was a totally political decision. I threw away the data, and I took out of Africa... Because, okay, the first part I said, I don't like being criticized by NGOs and academics. That's 100% political. That's totally impermissible, what I just said. And then the other one, which maybe could be defended, I'm going out of Africa to make an expression about the vision of the court. Maybe I could defend that. It's a preamble aim thing. But it's political. So the funny thing is, Moreno Ocampo is attacked for being political because all of his cases are in Africa. The problem, I think, is that he's being so rigidly... I think, but maybe this will be where you come in. Luis says, if you want equitable geographic distribution to be one of the factors, write it in the statute. If you put gravity, admissibility, jurisdiction, and an equitable geographic distribution, then I'll do it. So he says, if you want me to consider it, write it in the statute. So, you know, it's arguable that... it's arguable that he's being too rigidly formalistic, and so it's funny that the critique is framed as criticism. It's framed as political. So I think that I can sort of wind up from here. There's more tensions than the ones I just gave. I'll spend 2 minutes on one, which is how the ICC interacts with other aims. Let's say, and I originally had it as a scenario I would put to you, a peace process. There's a peace process going on. Would you defer? Would you charge on? And it's another one of these ones where you can't win. If you are deferential and you're saying, oh, I don't want to... I believe that the aims of international justice are important, but I also respect other aims. If you defer, then you'll get attacked as politicized because prosecutors aren't supposed to take into considerations other than criminal justice. So that's politicized. But if you don't pay attention to those other considerations and you go storming on ahead, then people are going to say, oh, you're on a crusade for international justice, you're disrupting all these other political things, you're politicized. So your choices are you're politicized or you're politicized. So I don't know which one you would be, but I suspect you're politicized. And what's funny in that situation is you could have a realist and a formalist watching a prosecutor, and they're both going to say, wow, this prosecutor is so political. And they actually mean opposite things, but it's going to be the same kind of critique. And I'll just end by just putting on the, like, because there we go. So these are kind of more of the sort of some of the options for the prosecutor. So this was a strange-ish talk, so this is why I'm extra interested in what you think of it, because it's a kind of broad, global look at the structure of the criticisms themselves. So, yeah, like I said, I'm really curious what you think. The discourse around the ICC, at the start, there was almost a sentiment of let's not criticize the court because it's a little baby and we want to protect it. And so it's healthy now that we got past that, right? People are criticizing the court. So the criticisms are important, they're valuable. I'm just pointing out that they're also, there's this recurring structure to them. And it is kind of funny because it's a little bit hard to defend the ICC because it's boring. I mean, if someone says, why did the court not go to this country? And you go, well, the jurisdictional rule. Why are they letting Libya take the case but not Kenya? And you say, well, Article 17 provides blah, blah, blah. Okay, one, that's boring. That's technical. No one even wants to listen. Two is you sound naive. Like, that's totally naive. That's so Pollyannish that you think these things are law. We all know much better. Or, in my case, because I worked at the ICC, it's like, obviously I'm part of the cover-up, right? I'm worried about the ICC, that how the discourse has gone, so that... It's getting a little lopsided. It's like I find it overly critical and not critical about its criticalness, if you see what I mean, right? So if anyone wants to ask questions on any of these tensions, I can sort of develop them, but you can sort of get the gist just to take one. Your charging decision, you're either too high or too low. If you go after, for example, the president, then I bring a utopia attack and I say, what are you doing? That's disruptive. That's crazy. If you charge anyone below the president, then I'm going to say you're cowardly. You're not following the evidence to its highest thing. So, and I mean, I could have slide after slide of these things, or this is the life of the international prosecutor. So I think that's the gist. So one, I think there's lots of things the ICC could and should do better, but I just want to dispel the idea that there's no just right. There's no porridge that's just the right temperature. That can't be achieved. Two, I'm not saying that any of the criticisms are wrong. It's possible that they could be substantiated, but I am just trying to point to this recurring structure so that we're a little more cautious in how we evaluate them. And yeah, three, and finally, I'm super interested in what people think, starting with Phil, because, you know, this is a strange talk I've given, so I'm really curious what people think. And I'll also, like, in the question period, if you want to either comment on what you thought of my whole schema, or if you just say, I'm curious about this or that detail about the ICC, if you're just curious about something, you know, I'm open to every kind of question.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. Made the invitation, so the only thing I have to do is leave this seat and offer it to Phil, who will come with some initial responses.
Good. Thanks, Daryl. I'm going to be brief because I think my role is more to maybe offer some thoughts that will help stimulate the Q&A, so I'm going to keep these very short. I hadn't seen the paper beforehand, so these thoughts are very much ad hoc. But I think there are sort of three reactions or three points that I'd give to your presentation. And I think that the thought that maybe connects the three is that I still wonder whether you're being a bit easy on the ICC.
Right.
I think the structure of your argument is quite compelling. I mean, I found myself sort of agreeing with you most steps of the way, except that I felt that there was maybe a prior thing that needed to be said, which is that maybe it's partly the court's fault that the criticisms of the institution have taken the form that they have. That I had the sense in your argument that you felt that most of the critics of the ICC were being sort of either unreasonable or perhaps even worse, inconsistent, and that you were kind of putting the burden of blame upon the critics. But my sense is that perhaps the court has been its own worst enemy in many cases. And I guess I want to try and explain what I mean by that. So there are sort of three reasons why I think the court perhaps is its own worst enemy in producing the problems that you've set out. The first is that I'm not sure that the challenges that you suggest the court is facing are in fact new challenges. And I think that's perhaps part of the frustration of some of the critics, and perhaps I would include myself here, in relation to the ICC, which is that most of the challenges that the court is facing at the moment, we have seen before. To take one example, the issue of cooperating with states and how you deal with these issues of dependence and independence. It's true that that's a core challenge, but the ICTR and the ICTY face essentially exactly the same problem. And you read Victor Peskin's book on the challenges of state cooperation, and much of what he talks about in relation to the ICTY and the ICTR are resonant for the challenges that the ICC is facing today. And it's not just that these types of challenges have emerged before in transitional justice, but we see them in a range of international actors operating on the ground in many settings. You could also think of humanitarian organizations that face precisely the same question. Part of the frustration with the ICC, I think, is that we're not seeing learning on... It doesn't seem that we're seeing learning on these particular issues. Having this long history of international interventions in domestic settings, why is it that we now see the ICC seeming to make exactly the same mistakes that we saw in previous institutions? And a lot of these challenges may have seemed new to lawyers who were drafting their own statute, but the challenges that you've suggested, particularly the political ones, I don't think are new to students of politics or international relations, which may tell us more about the type of actors who were involved in drafting the statute and who are involved in the court, rather than the nature of the challenges. I mean, on that point, I mean, something that's always struck me doing research at the ICC in The Hague is that, particularly in the Office of the Prosecutor, we still see an over-reliance on very generalist staff who don't have a deep knowledge of the particular context that the court will be working in. And I think if we go and look at the ICTY, one of the things that I think Louise Arbour did extremely effectively as prosecutor was that she hired political experts on the particular Balkan states where the tribunal would be working. And I think, and again, it's a point that Peskin makes in his book, one reason that he thinks that the ICTY eventually worked out how to navigate these difficult issues of state cooperation was that it had political experts within the staff who had a deep knowledge of how to kind of get around these challenges. I don't see that in the ICC. I see this over-reliance on generalists who were spending too long having to get up to speed on the specifics of the cases. So in that sense, that actually in many ways seems a step backwards from a policy that at least OTP in the ICTY adopted. So your nerds, I think, might be part of the problem here, I guess is what I'm kind of getting at. So that's the first point, is that, you know, I'm not sure that these challenges are that new and they could have been dealt with had the staff being directed in different ways. The second point, I guess, is also challenging this idea that the structure of these problems perhaps is the fault of the critics. I think part of the reason that we're seeing this very vociferous criticism of the court is because of a particular tone that I think the institution as a whole adopted in the very early days of its operations. And, I mean, it's refreshing, I think, to see someone like yourself come out of the institution and give us this kind of analysis. And there's a certain modesty and a certain recognition of limitations. But I think what sort of exacerbated or kind of agitated many critics in the early days of the court was that there were these very hubristic statements being made about what the ICC would do and what it would bring. The expectations were enormous. I think coming out of the experience of previous tribunals, a sort of more reasonable approach would have been to have said, look, this is going to be tough. You know, we are going to have to face all of these challenges. We are limited as an institution. So, you know, let's go easy on us. Because in many ways, we're not going to be any better than any institution that's come before. And I think that was perhaps part of the message that came out of the ICC in the early days, was we are going to be something better. You know, we've learned from the ad hoc tribunals, we've improved our methodologies, and so we're going to deliver something that that is significantly improved. To my mind, the message was kind of wrong there, and so expectations were sort of made, you know, right at the outset. Coupled with a certain defensiveness from the court in the early days as well, of almost, how dare you? You know, this is this beautiful, wonderful institution that is, you know, the sort of the wildest dreams of a certain human rights community are kind of manifest in this institution. You know, who are you to kind of tell us that we're getting it wrong? You know, are you kind of supporters of the dictators? You know,
right.
You know, that was almost the sort of logic of the defensiveness. So I think the message could have been carried more effectively by the court itself in the early days. So the tone that was adopted, I think, has often been problematic. The third and final point is, again, coming back to the structure of your argument, much of which I find compelling. I still think we have to distinguish between, and I think you even kind of were alluding to this in your final statement, we have to distinguish between inevitable challenges that the ICC has faced and will face, and categorical policy missteps.
Right.
And I think there's a danger that if this argument that you're giving us was kind of pushed to the nth degree, that it would let the ICC off the hook in key moments. I think some of the elements of the ICC's work in recent years that have really got the backs of the critics up relate to very particular decisions made especially by the prosecutor that I think actually are outside the structure of, you know, sort of apology and utopia. I think they're just categorical errors. You can think of things like, you know, and it's a small issue, but it had big resonance at the time, the prosecutor sitting next to President Museveni to announce the launch of investigations in Uganda. If there was this prior knowledge that, you know, problems of dependence and independence were going to come up, presumably as a prosecutor you'd be very attuned to that, you'd be very careful. And the last thing you'd want to be doing is appearing in public with the president of the state that you're going to be investigating. I think the message that sent was actually, we don't give a stuff about your politics. We actually don't care. It's not even that we recognise it's a challenge and we're going to have to navigate it. The institutional message was, it's not an issue, we're going to do whatever we damn well please anyway. I think one of the other problems that we're seeing with particularly the Office of the Prosecutor at the moment is a sense in the Congo cases that the institution is cutting investigative corners at almost every single step. If we look at the Lubanga decision recently, I think it's fair to say that the judges may have been quite generous to the prosecutor here. They stayed the proceedings twice and essentially coached the prosecutor, it seemed, at every step about how to develop a strong case. The problem in the Lubanga case was the evidence that was being collected was extremely weak, because the prosecutor was having to rely on intermediaries and a range of third parties to actually do the tough work of the court. Now, yes, that's structured by the political exigencies that you've described. It's structured by certain resource limitations. But also, that's an error in terms of how you should do investigative work. And had there been Congolese expertise built into the ICC's framework right from the start, anybody knowing that context would have said, you can't do investigations like this. You can't use intermediaries. It's going to compromise the case right from the outset. So I think these are the types of criticisms that, to my mind, are very, very important. I think they go to the heart of what the ICC is trying to do at the moment and don't necessarily fall into this structure of sort of apology versus utopia. I think there are just key problems or key mistakes being made. Final sort of connected point to that is also, and it's something that you said yourself, there's often been a lack of explanation from the court as to why certain decisions were being made at certain times. Now, partly, I think that's a symptom of this particular prosecutor, and we wait to see whether that changes under Ben Suda. But I think many critics could have accepted, or they could have compromised to many of the ICC statements had there actually been a sort of a trajectory for the court to come out and explain itself, to say, look, this is what we're up against, this is why we're doing what we're doing, we do have good explanations for this. But in the absence of explanations, the suspicion was there's something dirty going on in the background, or this is a court that's kind of making it up as it goes along. So I think it's that kind of ICC behaviour, I think, that has often fueled the kinds of criticisms that you're trying to deal with here. So that would be short summation of my thoughts.
Sure.
Thanks.
And I think the point about being easy on the court is a really good point, because by presenting everything in this spectrum format and emphasizing, as I do, that there's no just right porridge, it lets the ICC almost completely off the hook. They could drop their policy anywhere, and then I would say, well,
you're going to get attacked either way, right? So I think that's a really good point you're making. And that's something I... And that's why I emphasize some of the criticisms must have merit, but we just need more substantiation and an awareness of these kind of spectrums. I don't think that the tensions are the fault of the critics. What I was trying to suggest is they're the fault of the universe. you're pointing out some of them are just technical errors on the part of the court, which is quite right. Managing expectations, surely right. Although disappointing, it makes me think of Obama's acceptance speech. That was so disappointing. So managing expectations. Nonetheless, even the examples you picked, I think, still are examples of apology utopia. So one, I think most people would say Moreno Ocampo's biggest mistake was doing a press conference with Museveni at his side. And I think Luis himself thinks that was his biggest mistake. Mm-hmm. So fine. But there's a flip side to that is, I think just a week before that press conference, Luis had a conversation with someone who worked for the ICTR prosecutor. And the story there was African leaders are really irritated with the other international prosecutors who refuse to be photographed with them. And that's disrespectful to us and offensive. So the other prosecutors refuse to be photographed with the African leader. That's offensive, right? So then Luis is photographed with the African leader. Problem. So again, I think screwed and screwed are the kind of choices. And even Lubanga, which had all these things that went wrong, but even Lubanga. So the first time the Lubanga case collapsed was because of the prosecutor had received information in confidence from states, but some of it was potentially exonerating. And the ICC statute, fault of the drafters, morons, there's two obligations in the Rome statute. One says, when you're given information in confidence, you may not breach, you may not provide it. And there's another provision that says, you must disclose exculpatory information. And they're just sitting there in the statute, and they're like opposites. So the narrative from Fulford, the judge, if you read his judgment basically says, one day the crazy prosecutor woke up and decided to abuse the duty to disclose exonerating information. But if Luis had gone the other way and shared the information, then everybody would be going, what an idiot of a prosecutor, because he breached the confidentiality of the information providers, forever terminating the court's court. So I think I agree with Phil that errors are there, for sure. But even with those ones, even with those examples you gave, like, there's another side to it. And had you gone the other fork in the road, criticism awaits. So, but I'm sure there's a way to at least dial down the criticism. Sometimes when I show this to people, they say, you know, what do I take away from this idea of tensions? Like, should the prosecutor or the judges go for the place where there's the least volume of criticism? Should you go for the place where it's like the stereo is equal on either side? And I guess I don't think either. I don't think the function of the court is to minimize criticism. Its function is probably to maximize its impact. So there we go. Shall we? Yeah.
Thanks very much. I am.